Welcome to Chase Your Dream, a podcast that believes that all dreams can come true if you have the courage to pursue them. Each week, we deliver the stories of a common person being successful by chasing the dream. I am your host, Shoman.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to a very special episode of Chase Your Dream. Today, we have among us Jan Candy, who is a psychologist, writer, photographer, educationist, and also a cancer survivor. Jan, welcome to my show.
Thank you for having me.
So our audience wants to know more about you, your journey in life.
Well, it's been curvy and curly and unexpected, at least lately. In the beginning, I had a fairly conventional life. As things unfolded, I had a great childhood, my wonderful parents. I loved school. Got along pretty good with my siblings, was healthy, nothing dramatic. And that proceeded for many years. I went on to graduate school and I was in the midst, very end of completing my postdoctoral fellowship in psychology. So I would have been about 35 or so. And my husband failed to come home from work one night. And the next morning I called the police station to have him reported as a missing person, which they didn't do much about initially. But another week went by and I was notified by the homicide division at the Detroit Police Department in Michigan in the United States to come down there and talk with the inspector. And the long and short of it was that they had believed he'd been murdered, but they did not yet have his body. And back in 1985, you needed that because DNA was not what it is today. So I left not knowing much. I had more questions than answers. Another week went by, and then I met Detective Marlis Landeros, who was in charge of the investigation. She was an amazing, amazing person. She kept me together. I couldn't have been luckier than to have her in charge of things. She was the first woman of color to be in the department in any position of authority. She looked younger than she was, and she looked less experienced than she was, but she was very competent, very professional, very thorough. And she was even tuned into nuances, like she knew when not to talk. She knew when I was not able to take any more information in and I just needed to take a breath. So she was a really big ally. She's a big part of the story. At any rate, they called me back down for a second interview, except when I got there, they said what I really needed to do was accompany them to the morgue to identify him. They had discovered he'd been murdered in Detroit, but dismembered and carried to Petoskey, Michigan, up north towards Canada, kind of. And buried in a shallow bog. One of the accomplices came forward. He wasn't involved in the murder. He was involved in the burial. And he said he would turn state's evidence for immunity. And so he filled in a lot of the gaps. So that morning was a double whammy, because not only did I have to go through the identification process with Detective Landeros and maybe other people. I don't recall. I was kind of living on I was exhausted at that point, and I don't recall a lot of the details specifically, but I do recall that we left that room after I identified him, and we were headed out the front door of the building, which was very old by our standards. And there was a mass of reporters assembled. This was already on a Sunday morning. I didn't expect anybody to be down there. And I'm not normally given to drama and exaggeration, but I want to share with you this one detail because it conveys with you the state of mind I had at this moment. I, as I said, was very tired. I hadn't been eating. I had just seen a very gruesome identification of my husband. And as I was leaving that building, when I looked out the front door, before I pushed open the door, I thought what I saw was a machine gun on a turret. And I froze, and Detective Landeros sensed my tension and turned me around. We went out the back door. Well, obviously, in retrospect, all I saw was a camera on a tripod, but it certainly speaks to my state of mind at that time. At any rate, the media was relentless from then on. They were very, very intrusive in the funeral situation, which took place the following week. The next big hurdle was the preliminary examination, which is the way that the two people who were charged with the crime were given their rights, as well as the charges they faced. That was the first time I'd ever seen them in person. I'd seen them in the news, but never in person. And by that time, this is like now from July, now we're moving to December. And at that point in time, I had moved away from being frightened to being really angry that they had done this, that they had placed me in this situation. And I remember going, I had been subpoenaed to go to the court, so I had no say in it, I had to appear. And I remember walking towards the front of the courtroom, and the defendants were on my left, and it was very crowded. And I behaved as if I'd been jostled, and I slammed my hand on the defendant's table. But really, I was just angry, and I wanted to say, I'm here, and we have you, and you're gonna have to pay for what you did. So I got to the witness stand. It was very brief. I was in and out quickly. And I elected not to go to the trial. I know for some people who go through this, that's a big step for them. They want to be there. They want to bear witness to what happened. And I wanted no part of it. And the reason was because nothing in my life would change. I would still be a widow. I'd still live in a house that held memories that I was going to have to sell. Oh, and another thing was I had learned through the police that he had given these two people that ended up murdering him all of our savings and a photo album of the contents of our house. So that was another reason I was glad to sell the house. So I found out I was broke and I was worried about homelessness. So in the next year, I changed my phone number so many times to evade the press, I had to write it down to remember it. And that's when my journey to recovery started, because at a certain point, I decided enough is enough. I mean, my physician called me down and said, you're not sleeping, I need to check you out. And he knew me very well. He was like a father to me, so he could speak frankly. And he said, I'm gonna test you for AIDS too, because of your husband's behaviors. And AIDS had just been discovered, and the ELISA test had been only approved the previous week. So it was imperfect. And he said, you'll have to be retested for the next 7 years to be out in the clear. And I just thought, you know, I want to take back control of my life. They've taken my health, they've taken my house, they've taken my savings, my husband, my peace of mind, my privacy, enough is enough. And it was then that I decided to take back control and make decisions that would eventually set me on a path back to where I am today. That isn't to say that you ever get back to the baseline, but you do have to take the reins and make lemonade out of lemons, so to speak. And basically what I decided at that moment in time was I either would be a victim or I would be someone who overcame this. And for me, there was no question. I was definitely not going to give in to anything else. And I definitely felt I had the ability and the opportunity and the support that I needed to move on, and I did.
So you changed the house at that point of time, went to another place, and you started a new life again. So if you can highlight a small part on that.
The house itself was an issue because the laws stated at that time, I don't think they've changed even, that if a major crime occurred with the owner, then you had to disclose that information to a potential buyer in case they were superstitious. If you didn't, they could rescind the offer at any time in the future. So the house was devalued. I found out I was $30,000 in debt, which today is closer to $75,000. So everywhere I turned, there was a fire to put out, so to speak. And I loved the new place I moved to. I considered it my safe house. I was very happy there, but the media was relentless. And I was tired of being called the widow. And I just decided if I'm ever gonna take back control of my life, I have to leave. And I did not really want to do that. I liked where I lived. I missed my friends. I would miss the culture that it was a multicultural environment in Detroit. I loved its music. I loved its food. I knew it like the back of my hand. It was home, but I had to give it up. So I moved away to a place where people didn't know me, and I did not speak of it for 30 years. Did not go there. And I switched from clinical work as a psychologist to teaching, and I loved it. I found I really, really loved teaching. My specialty became cross-cultural psychotherapy, and I thought if I'm going to do cross-cultural work, I should travel more internationally. So I did, and my goal was to make all 7 continents. I have yet 2 to go because of COVID. It got in my way. But my point was that if I'm going to teach cross-cultural psychotherapy, I should travel because you can bring back stories and photographs. I took up photography. I also, one of the things I did to get myself back on track is get in physical shape. And I ended up doing 5 triathlons. I met a group of wonderful people. We met 4 mornings a week at 6:30. And that ended up saving my life, which I hadn't expected, because I was in training to do another triathlon when I slipped and fell and broke my arm. And that's how my cancer was discovered early, which made it more treatable, which I had no inkling I would have had cancer in me. So that was part of it. The physical, I took care of my physical. I traveled a lot. And when I traveled internationally, I found this was a big part of my healing. I found that by traveling internationally, it really put my life in perspective better than anything else could have. I met people who had far worse situations than I did. People that didn't have basic human rights, people that didn't have clean water, people that had multiple homicides, that lived in substandard housing, that had no voting privileges, that not an adequate diet, I mean, you name it. And I admired them for their resilience and their linguistic abilities. And I just thought, you know, I don't have it that bad. I've got resources. I've got my education. I got my health. At that point, I thought I did. And I couldn't feel sorry for myself. That wasn't even a possibility. And it made me grateful for everything I did have that I took for granted prior to that, like clean water and paved roads and adequate food and my health and insurance and all the stuff that I had that it's easy to overlook when you just focus on the negative. So that was a big part of my healing too. And then years went by, didn't talk about it. No one knew in my new environment what had happened. But 3 things happened in the same week that changed that, where I came out and talked about it for the beginning of talking about it. The 3 things were, I was at work and a coworker went missing, and people were gossiping kind of about it and saying to me, you know, can you imagine having somebody in your family missing? And I'm going, oh no, can't imagine that. And privately I'm thinking, of course I can imagine that, I lived it. And I began to feel inauthentic myself because, you know, I did know and I was lying to them. The second thing, that same day, there was a lecture at work by a physician on some topic, I don't remember. But as a side comment, he made the statement that people who live with a secret for years pay a price physically. And I'm like, that's not good. And I went back to my office to kind of think on those 2 things. And I looked over at a shelf I had of books that were special to me because they were all written by first person accounts of people who'd been through all kinds of traumatic situations from all over the world and came through it okay, very different situations. And I thought, you know, if they can step up and talk about it, I can too. It's not impossible. So I made the decision to finally start talking about it. And much to my amazement, people were very supportive. They were not judgmental. And I felt better, I slept better. And anyway, I ended up years later, I was engaged to be married, and even he had to pull it out of me. I didn't want to talk about it. All I would say was I was married before and he was killed, and I would talk about it eventually. I mean, and he pulled it out of me basically. But I ended up in the last few years, I wrote a book called A Life Divided. My goal was to kind of put the spotlight on the journey of anybody who's been through this situation, not just myself. Because we're a largely unknown group and we're international, it can strike anybody at any time, any age, any wealth level, you name it. I mean, it's an equal opportunity club. And sadly, some people have had it happen more than once to them. So I wrote the book to try to talk about this experience so other people could understand it subjectively. And the other thing I did, and it was at a suggestion of a relative of mine, is I started a podcast called The Domino Effect of Murder to talk about a lot of the very complicated and unexpected things that can happen following a homicide to people. I wanted to have that not only to connect with other people who'd been through it, but just to spread awareness about the situation and to make it different from television, which doesn't really say much about us at all. And what is portrayed is pretty inaccurate. So here I am.
So the name of the book is A Life Divided, right?
Correct.
So it is now available in audio formats also.
It's an audio book as well. I had a man who read the book contact me, and he was an audio engineer, and he volunteered to do the audio book with me, which was a huge, you know, thing to give me. So I did that last year, last September. And it was interesting. It was dehydrating, but I finished it. And it's now available on audio format as well.
So we would like to have some light about the cross-cultural psychological thing. So I have a lot of questions on that. So what does actually cross-cultural psychology focus on?
It's trying to help the therapist in training not assume that there's only one way to look at the world and how to meet people halfway and look at the world through their cultural eyes. Here's an example. If I was working with a psychiatrist and I recommended an antidepressant medication that happened to be in a blue pill, members of some cultures would look at the blue color and be abhorred by that. You know, that means that's a bad omen. Or you might want to work only with the entire extended family, that it would be disruptive and counterproductive to work with just an individual, to remove them from the family and work with them one-on-one would not be the good way to go. And many psychologists, that's all they're trained in. They don't know how to work with families, let alone extended families or groups. Social work does, but not psychology. So it helps you understand the importance of not removing the individual from their family and working with them by themselves. So it's trying to broaden their view and help them look at the person's culture so that they don't make mistakes, they don't make assumptions in working with them. And now it's still not the ideal. It's still better, I believe, to work with somebody who is of your own cultural background. But that's not always feasible, especially if you live in a rural area. But it's better than working with an individual who has no cultural awareness, and especially if they've never traveled outside the U.S. and they look at everything through our eyes, you know, through the eyes of somebody who's only been raised here. Matter of fact, when my kids were younger, I took them with me out of the country for the same reason. I wanted to open their eyes to how big the world is and how the variety of things that are out there, and we're just a small part of it.
Like what you hear so far? Make sure you never miss a show by clicking the subscribe button now. This podcast is made possible by listeners like you. Thank you for your support. Now back to the show.
So what is the importance of cross-cultural psychology?
I think it broadens your ability to work with a much broader population, and I think it also seasons you as a clinician. I had it put to me this one way, and I've never forgotten it. Somebody said to me, if you can only do psychotherapy from your own ethnic and cultural background, it's like living in a mansion and never leaving a room. There's a whole nother set of rooms out there that you won't even know exists. But by being trained cross-culturally, especially if you can speak different languages, which I wish I could, I've tried, but I've not been successful in that realm very well. If you can, especially if you can speak other languages and if you've traveled widely, it's like you've got the whole mansion now. You're not limited to just staying in your one room.
So how is cross-cultural psychology differs from other branches of psychology?
You just have more tools at your disposal. You may work more, not only with the extended family, but work more with rituals, or you might weave into your clinical plan like have them bring in statues that mean a lot to them. You can have them share with you a ceremony, be a part of the ceremony. For example, I had an opportunity to meet with a young man who was an Ojibwa American Indian. And I felt very honored that at the end of our work together, he invited me to a smoke ceremony. I'd never been to one. And I don't understand anything he said because it wasn't in English, it was in Ojibwa. But I understood the ceremony, and it was in this very hot tent in the middle of winter, covered with quilts, and it was full of smoke, and I was never been so hot in my life. And we passed this pipe around, and he threw sage on the fire, and it sparkled, and I don't know what he was saying, but the whole purpose of the ceremony was to welcome me and to symbolically recognize his advanced education as a healer. And it was impressive. I was very pleased to be a part of it. And that's not something we're trained ordinarily to participate in, let alone understand the significance of it, because there aren't a lot of people that look like me that would be invited to a smoke ceremony. And I really enjoy those kinds of experiences. I take them whenever I can. This is a little bit of an aside, but I went on a photography tour with a friend, I didn't know him well, but a person I knew in Arizona, and I expressed my interest in the cross-cultural dimensions of the Hopi American Indians. And he let me alone with them for hours, and I met the grandson of a healer. And by this time it was dark, and he took me up to the third mesa, to a Wolpe. Wolpe is the oldest continually occupied town or community in North America, and whites are not allowed there. But I went up anyway, and I was so impressed. I mean, it's just so life-changing to be a part of that. It makes you look at yourself different. It makes you look at your experiences. It changes you. It does, and for the good. And I just felt a part of a bigger family. I don't know how else to express it. I just welcomed those opportunities, and I hated it when COVID said, no, you have to stay home. So eventually I want to travel again.
So culture and suicide, if we take it side by side, we will find that Japan is having the highest rate of suicide followed by US. So a general study has shown that affluent countries have more suicidal rates than those countries which are on the suburbs, regions and all. So can you explain something?
That affluent cultures have what? I didn't hear you.
Affluent countries have a higher suicidal rates.
Ah, yes, they do. They do. Boy, that's a hot topic. Suicide is much more prevalent than homicide, and it's growing exponentially. I think, this is just my opinion, I'm not basing this on research, but I think when you get affluent, whoops, hold on a second.
Yeah.
Can you hear?
Yeah, loud and clear.
There we are back, I'm back on. I think affluent cultures tend to give people a false sense of control. You can buy this, you can go there, you can do this, you can control. And you find at certain points you can't. You could be fired, you could be divorced, your child could be missing, and people turn to drugs because they're available and they're a cheap fix. I think when you're affluent, you're not taught patience, you're not taught to appreciation like you need to be. You take things for granted in a big way. So as you come up in life, you're not equipped to handle frustration. You're not equipped to handle disappointment. You can't buy your way out of every situation. Your connections can't always save you. And I think without the tools to withstand frustration and disappointment, people turn to drugs often. Even if they don't, I think they get despondent and depressed and frustrated and angry, and they don't want to deal with life as it really is. And so a quick way out is to commit suicide rather than face the consequences of their situation. Because a lot of people that commit suicide have, like I said from my own life a few minutes ago, have so much going for them, but they don't appreciate it. They don't realize the pluses in their life. They just focus on the negative. And I think it's so important that we all appreciate what we do have. I think it's important to have frustration tolerance, to even raise our children in a way that they have it. I remember one thing my mentor taught me in doing family therapy. He said, you would hope to have a child raised by imperfect parents because it helps them prepare for an imperfect world. And that is true. The world is not perfect. Inevitably, you're going to have problems come up. I don't care how much money you have. I don't care how famous you are, how physically strong you are. There's going to be stuff that comes up. But deal with it. You don't just try to take a shortcut out of it and banish it. It's not that easy. And I think people just don't have the emotional wherewithal to cope. They've never been expected to have to, so they turn to suicide.
So do different culture experiences emotions differently?
Yes, very much. For example, when I was in China, I found people were very reserved and you didn't know what they were thinking or, you know, very polite, very formal, at least with me. I don't know what they were like behind closed doors with their family, but publicly they were very reserved, very polite. And I think their politeness in part was because of their reverence for people as they get older, which we don't have in the United States. The older you get, the less respect you get. And versus when I was in Guatemala, which I just loved, I would have moved there if I could have. Their emotions were on their sleeve. They were joyous. The people I met, they love their arts and their music and their dance, and they didn't have a lot in terms of possessions, perhaps, but very creative, very joyous. I just love being their music, especially. I just love their music, and very different. You know, they were very outgoing and more like my family was coming up. We were very raucous. I think my husband, who died, was not. His family was very reserved. I'm not as comfortable in that environment as I am, where you know what people are thinking and feeling and can be outgoing, but everybody's different. And you learn that when you travel and when you have friends that are from different backgrounds. My closest longest term friend is from Lebanon, and she's taught me things too. In fact, she was instrumental in helping me through packing the house and going to his grave and so on. And she has a good sense of humor. And so I view myself as lucky for having had those experiences of meeting people from all over the world, not just on podcasts, but in person.
So what are the methods of cross-cultural research?
What are the methods?
Of research, of cross-cultural research.
Well, in my opinion, the best methods are those done by individuals from within the culture in conjunction with somebody outside the culture, because then you get the best of both worlds. You get some objectivity with some subjectivity. And you can do various things. For example, there was a study that was done on American Indian children that showed that this is a while ago, teachers did not understand why the children gave away their food, why their mothers would pack them like 10 sandwiches and they would never eat it. So they just set up a situation in which they gave the children, they swapped their with the permission of the parents, they swapped their lunches to figure out what would happen. And they gave the American Indian child one sandwich and the Caucasian kids the 10 sandwiches. And what they found that the American Indian child did was divide the sandwich into small pieces so that they ended up having many different lunches. And the other child tried to eat it all. Well, the reason the mother, they realized later, was packing such a big lunch is she assumed it was for everybody. There's a groupness in it, a sharing attitude. And the Caucasian child was mother was packing for their child. So it just demonstrates that their worldview is so different. You put your group in front of you, yourself as an individual. There's different, you can even do research at a biological level and put people of different cultures within an MRI and expose them to seeing different photographs, and you'll get different experiences at a molecular level within the brain. For example, if I were to see an elephant, and I'd never ever seen an elephant in real life, maybe in the zoo, but never in real life, I might have a very neutral experience, a neutral reaction. My MRI would not flare up and show much reaction except, oh, okay, it's an animal, it's an elephant. But having been to India where I was exposed to some very dangerous, I mean to Africa where I was exposed to some very dangerous elephants, and I was cautioned again and again, do not go out after dusk. These elephants will kill you. They're very different from Indian elephants. And this one woman I met, her husband was killed by one. They were just on a walk at night. And it's amazing, these things are so big and they can hide behind a tree and you don't see them, even though they're huge. And he took his trunk and took this husband of hers and threw him on the ground and stomped him to death in front of her. And I'm like, yikes. So I've never looked at an animal, at an elephant the same since. I've never, prior to that, never thought of them as dangerous, but they can be. So my point is that if you took an American who's never seen a real elephant except in the zoo, they might at the MRI level show no reaction. Whereas somebody who's been to Africa who knows the truth of what they're capable of, it fires up and you'll see a big difference. That their fear response is very exaggerated based on their experiences.
So you have also worked as a forensic psychologist.
What is what?
You have also worked as a forensic psychologist.
Forensic, yes, I have. I don't know about you. Many people assume forensic means criminal. It doesn't, it just means legal. So in my work as a forensic psychologist, my job was to evaluate people who were coming into a very, very large psychiatric hospital to see if they were in danger to themselves, imminent danger to themselves, imminent danger to others, meaning suicide. Danger to self means suicidal. Or imminent danger to others, meaning homicidal. Or just unable to care for themselves. They were too psychotic. They would go out in the winter with no clothes on and freeze to death. And my evaluation of them showed that they met one of those three criteria, danger to self, danger to others, or grave disability, then my job, my role, my responsibility was to go to court and get them committed against their will, where you remove their rights temporarily and say, you are committed to a psychiatric hospital for this period of time. And then I accompanied them to court in front of a judge and tried to persuade the judge to retain them against their will, remove their rights temporarily, so until such time that they could be restored, if they could be, not all could be, and then they would be released. Yeah, I did that for a number of years.
So how do you put your feelings aside to assess the patient's objective?
Well, that's probably 98% of the time. There were a couple of times it was really hard to, but I think part of it comes through your training. You're taught. Your role there is not to be their friend. Your role there is not to be a sister or a brother. Your role there is to help this individual. They already probably have people in their life who do care for them emotionally, and they don't need somebody decompensating. That's not going to help them. It's like if you go to the ER with a broken leg, you don't want the physician to start crying. You want them to help you. That was my role. My role was to step aside, be objective in a caring way, but not in a close-knit way, and guide them through what they needed to be guided through, that it shows caring in another capacity. And the way I was trained, what I was taught to do, and I think it was effective, was if I felt strong emotions welling up inside of me, and I did at times, I would hear very awful things, animal torture, for example, and I love animals. So rather than react like if I would have as a neighbor, I had to sit there and listen to this guy talk about what he did with his blowtorch on his dog. I just stuffed it in a cabinet in the back of my mind. I pictured it like that. And then after he left, it's like I sat down and opened that cabinet and processed and thought about and reacted as I normally would without his presence, away from him, what my reactions were to what I had just heard. And the advantage of doing that is you're not just stuffing it, and it's building over time. Neither are you letting it interfere with what's going on in the clinical setting, but you still are authentic to yourself. Sometimes it would be the other extreme. Sometimes it would be somebody who had a homicide in their family in a very similar situation to myself, and my heart just went out to them. But I would not be of much help to them by breaking down in front of them. My help to them would be using all my resources of what I've been trained to do, as well as my training from my personal experience, and guiding them much like somebody who guides somebody through the jungle. I mean, you know the way, you know the paths, you know the dangers, you know the tools, and your job is to be a few steps ahead of them and provide them with that till such point that they don't need it. And it really does come automatically after you've done it again and again and again. So you turn it off, you deal with the person, they leave, then you can turn it back on and process it till the next time it happens. And not everybody reaches you that way, but it's inevitable that it's going to happen sooner or later. And if it doesn't, then something's wrong, because you don't want to turn into a machine. It's a balance, I guess I could say, between being a guide and being a human. You need both.
If assume that you have a billboard with you, so what do you want to put it over there and why?
Say again.
Assume that you are having a billboard with you. What do you want to put on the billboard and why?
Oh, never been asked that. What would I put on the billboard? Well, let's see, a lot of different kinds of people would read it. So I guess I would fall back on a favorite saying of mine, which is that if you don't want to be a part of the problem, then you have to be a part of the solution. I'm not a fan of people who whine and complain. I really think everybody can do something to help, even if it's minor. And in my experience, again, I was maybe speaking more of Americans than anybody, but I hear a lot of complaining. And I'm like, stop, just stop. Well, what can we do about this? Let's get over the complaining and talk about problem resolution. How can we fix this? What can we improve? And is it even a problem? Sometimes it's just something that's temporary that'll pass. So I'm a big believer in that. And I think that's what my billboard would say is, you know, be a part of the solution, not a part of the problem.
Any message for my listeners?
Any message for the listeners?
Yes.
Thank you for your patience. And I hope that if you by chance have had a homicide of somebody close to you or a friend of yours, that you know there are resources out there. There are people that have traveled the path. It is possible to get your footing again. It's not easy, but it's possible. And that there are people that care and will help. You have to connect, but they're there.
So if you could step in my shoes, what you have asked yourself that I haven't?
I guess at my age, having just had my 70th birthday, I would say, you know, what do you want your epitaph to be? What do you want your legacy to be? Because as you get older, you start thinking about that, you know. And I would say that my legacy, my epitaph would read that I I really tried. I can't say I always succeeded, but I really tried hard to leave the world in a better place than I found it. In various ways, through my art, through my podcast, through raising my children the way I did, through my travels, through my book, through encouragement of people, through the adoption of many animals over the years, that I tried really hard, and I hope I succeeded at that.
So when is your birthday?
Any what?
When is your birthday?
Oh, it was. It was June 22nd, last month.
Wishing you a very, very belated happy birthday.
Thank you. It was my first surprise party. My husband threw a surprise party. I was totally shocked. A friend of mine, he asked her to take me to this nursery because I love gardens, love gardening all the time. And so she kept delaying us leaving, and I'm like, okay, I'm ready to go. No, we have to wait. And finally, we came back to my house, and I saw a bunch of people in the shadows underneath the roof of the house looking out. And my first thought was, is something happened? Why are all these people here? And then they started waving and singing happy birthday. And I'm like, oh, that's right. It's my birthday. And I went in, there was all this food and decorations, and it was fun. I love having it. And that the fact that my husband would go to that effort for me was nice too. So that was a big deal for me. I didn't think I'd make 70. I mean, when I got my cancer diagnosis, it looked pretty bleak. And here I am 6 years later and doing fine.
What does chase your dream mean to you?
It means being authentic. It means thinking outside the box, being open to experiences, connecting with other people, especially people different in my viewpoint, especially people different from yourself. Listening to what you enjoy, even if it doesn't make sense to people around you. I don't like it when people discourage people from following their dreams, saying, well, that's not realistic, or how are you going to accomplish that? Because if you have a dream, whether it's being a talent or finding joy in art, whatever it might be, if you follow it, you're a happier person. And even if you can't do it as your mainstay job, you certainly can do it on the side. And it makes you a happier person. If you're a happier person, that's a positive ripple effect for everybody around you. And we need all kinds of people. That was one of the lessons my parents drove home to me early on, is we need all kinds of people, and they're right. And you're not going to get that if you keep discouraging people and saying you have to do what I do and just go to work at a job you hate. You know? But discover what it is you like. And sometimes people don't even know what it is they like. And again, that's why I think exposure is so important, to travel, to meet other people and explore. And when my kids were little, I would take them to the library, and we would just go through, because this is before the internet, we would talk about different careers, things that they'd never heard about. And that's why when they got older, I took them to other continents, just to open the doors up and to show them the possibilities that are out there. So following your dream, I think, is making you a happier person, which translates into making others around you happy, which translates into a happier world, really. If everybody did it or tried to do it, I think we'd be in a better position than we are today.
So with that, we came to the end of the show. It was an pleasure to have you in my show.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you for joining us this week. Don't forget to subscribe us on any platform, be it Anchor.fm, Spotify, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, JioSaavn, CastBox, etc. Also tell your friend, family members and enemies about the show. Be sure to tune in next week for another new episode. Myself Shoman Sengupta signing off. Not before saying, all dreams can come true, provided you have the courage to pursue them.